Hi, everybody. Matt Polka here with another edition of Cable Talk, podcast brought to you by the American Cable Association. We're talking cable, we're talking broadband, we're talking lots of issues with neat people in the cable and broadband industry. So don't forget, subscribe, rate, and review. You can find Cable Talk at our website, americancable.org, at the hub, or you can find us on iTunes. So let's get on with Cable Talk. All right, here we are at Cable Talk. Once again with Cable Talk, I am pleased to have my good friend Mike Greb, who is the publisher of Cable Facts magazine, a publication that hits my desk every morning that I read.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff, right? A lot of things to cover these days, definitely.
Tell us a little bit about your background, in the journalism business and rising to become publisher of Cable Facts.
Yeah, well, I started off at one of our, competitors, Communications Daily, and I had I was in D.C. This is in the early 90s, and I just graduated college. We were in the middle of a pretty bad recession, as people may recall. Not as bad as the 2008, 2009 thing. It wasn't that bad, but it was pretty bad. There weren't many jobs. I had, sort of a job that was, very low-paying and not really in my skill set, and I was just doing it while I was sending out resumes everywhere, and one of the first that came back just happened to be Warren Publishing, and of course I go in there, and Dan Warren has got a stack of resumes, did this on purpose just to mess with me, he puts a whole stack of resumes that he had from all these different people because there's a bad job market, and he said, what do you got, kid? And I had this interview and they gave me a writing test, and it was an interesting lesson because I was up against all these other people, and I think the only reason I got the job is because it was actually Mike Fiesel, who I think you know pretty well.
Sure do.
And they just had me do a random writing test where, and it wasn't even on a telecom topic, it was just Mike had just adopted somebody, had just adopted a baby girl from China who's now actually graduating college.
That's how old I am.
Now, I think she's graduated college a while ago. Yeah, thank you. I do this interview with Mike. It was just about his adoption. It was a very simple thing. They gave me 3 hours to write it. They said, just leave. I think I had to bring it back or something because there wasn't even email back then. And so I write this thing and I'm sitting there. They just wanted me to do a basic, just get the quotes that you took, make sure I got the quotes right and the facts right and things. And I sort of got curious about it and I crack open, there's no internet, so I crack open the phone book. And there was some association of adoption or something. And so I called the lady there. She just answers the phone. And she happened to have some stats that I integrated into the article. And I threw a quote in from her. And I think that's the reason I got the job, that I just went that little extra step
Mile.
And it actually, those are the type of moments in life where you just learn that lesson, that if you just do a little bit
extra,
more,
right?
Sometimes it can just put you a little bit over the top. So that was just a random thing because it was the first, I had no real interest necessarily in cable and broadband. That just happened to be the first thing that came back.
Just looking for a job.
And I got the job, and then that became my career. But, that led to other things and eventually to cable. I covered a lot of .com stuff in the late 90s and freelance for a while, and then I ended up back in cable with Cable Facts about 11 years ago.
Well, it's great to work with you. This is a fun episode of Cable Talk for me because I have a journalism background as well. I was a reporter way back when, got my degree in news editorial, so kid out of the Watergate generation, so I was learning how to write stories as well, and I enjoyed newspapers, but got into cable because that was the job that they gave me, as a young lawyer who went to law school thereafter. But
we're also directionless, aren't we?
We're just looking for a job, and who knows? It's a career.
But it usually turns out pretty well.
It does. And I never would have expected it, but here we are, 25 years later.
Yeah.
And literally coming to you from the Grand
Hyatt
Hotel.
We used to talk, by the way. You were one of the first people I met the industry when I was at ComDaily, 22 years old.
Exactly.
Had the cable regulation monitor. You remember that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every year in the fact book and everything like that.
Yeah.
So we are coming to you from the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Washington, D.C., the site of our ACA summit, our 25th annual summit. You got started about the time the American Cable Association got started back in 1993, and we did have some conversations early on while we were trying to get some coverage. You remember anything about us back then?
I just remember it was a big part of me learning, when I first started covering the industry, I initially was covering the larger companies. And back then, the larger companies were not as big as they
are today. Not as big as they are today, right.
And they weren't as integrated. They didn't have content. It was a much different world. But you still had relatively, I think Time Warner Cable was probably one of the bigger ones, and TCI was the big
one. Yeah, TCI was the big one.
The John Malone and all that. They were the biggest one. But compared by today's standards, they'd be considered a tier two, I mean, as to where they were back then. But so the industry was a lot more fractured. But I sort of, I was covering a lot of those larger operators. And I remember that this was sort of an entree that I had into this whole other side of the business and different issues, and that's still the case today. It might be even more the case today.
It very much is, particularly as we look at new technologies, but who's going to serve these smaller markets, but these smaller companies that live and work there, and the bigger companies don't want to serve there. So, and particularly with Washington's interest in making sure that rural areas have broadband just like anywhere else, you know, whether it's in the middle of D.C. or anywhere else. But you certainly have covered it all, really, over the last years. And again, I hate you because you haven't changed at all since I've known you. And
I've changed
a bit
now.
You
have a bad memory.
That's for sure. But what has been most interesting to you with all of the time that you've spent? Again, very similar in the sense that we got jobs in the industry and we made it a career. I mean, what has been most interesting from your perspective in working in this industry and covering it to see the growth of it, et cetera? But I mean, what's one of the things that really kind of drives your interest in the industry?
Well, I think it's always changing. I think, you know, you could say that, I guess, about a lot of different industries. There's always change in any industry. Things are changing. But it seems to be a lot more rapid in this industry, and so it always keeps things interesting, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like covering, I don't know. I imagine, I don't know anything about the oil industry, but I imagine it doesn't change quite as quickly, and it's not quite as sexy as this, you know? We're not talking about, you know, there's the component of distribution, which is really interesting on the technology side a lot of times, and on the business side, and kind of how people make all that work. And then there's the whole content side of the business. It's kind of all the Hollywood stuff that's a lot of fun. And so it's kind of that integration of entertainment and technology and a lot of different things. And it just keeps, and then with that constantly changing, and the business constantly changing, and with just really robust competition all the time. I mean, there's been competition in this business at least since the early 90s when I started because of DBS.
Absolutely.
And DBS, you know, went through this wave of importance, and then it was everyone was on broadband pretty quickly in the mid-90s to the late 90s. And, you know, that sort of just continued through, and now we have OTT that everyone's worried about or we're trying to work with in some way. The regulatory part of this business has always been interesting,
part of the story,
which is your big area because
you're
such a Washington guy and coming in here and lobbying people, and you're constantly dealing with new regimes at the White House, new regimes in Congress,
always turnover,
and new philosophies about it's the pendulum. I mean, if you look at how the pendulum has swung since we got to know each other, it's just literally
been.
And
how many times it's gone back?
Yeah, just every 8 years, pretty much.
Pretty much,
with one exception. Well, actually, that predates us, right? That would have been Dukakis. I mean, otherwise, it's just been eight.
Yeah.
You know,
back and forth
and back and forth.
I
think that all that stuff means that every year it's different, and you have to look at it differently, and it forces you to keep track of all these changes that's going on.
So as you're looking at the industry, what are some of the big stories that you feel are most important now? And 5-10 years, what are going to be the headlines as this industry changes?
Well, one thing that I think is really interesting, we actually, we didn't get a chance, Matt and I just came from another roundtable and we talked about a lot of cool subjects. And one we didn't get to was artificial intelligence.
Oh my, yes.
I think is probably, you know, and we talked a little bit about driverless cars, things that came up in some context of wireless. But, you know, really you combine things like driverless cars, artificial intelligence, what's going on with, sort of the recommendation engines in terms of entertainment and what's going on with customer service in terms of AI. I think it's weaving its way into pretty much everything that has any touch point with consumers. And obviously it's affecting this industry as much as it's going to affect all industries. But, it has a lot of implications for a lot of things for just the country, you know, like the jobs that it's going to eliminate.
Sure.
And it's already eliminating.
Right.
I mean, you look at autonomous cars, and just that part of it's going to eliminate, 3 million truck drivers?
Easy.
This is a serious issue, you know, for everybody.
Huge.
And the same thing's going to happen with customer service agents as AI gets better and better at feeling like a human that can basically deal with basic problems that people might have, the customers might have. Mm-hmm. You know, so for an operator, you may end up saving a lot of money. you know, once you deploy the technology, but then, you know, what happens to those jobs? Where do those people go and stuff like that? So
I sometimes wonder, you know, as a kid who read all the sci-fi stories and watched the sci-fi movies, particularly The Terminator and The Rise of the Machines, yeah. if we're not going down that path. You know, we started with this great thing called the internet, and now it seems a little bit out of control with the next new development.
It's funny how we bring it upon ourselves, too, right?
True,
I mean, because some of the dystopian fiction from decades ago, yeah. 1984 and stuff, it was always imposed upon us
by
a government.
Cyberspace, I mean, yeah. cybersecurity issues and bringing down the grid or bringing
right.
down the financial system, which creates, you know, ruin that we've read in, you know, The Road, you know, by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that sort
yeah.
of thing. So
we're getting really literary
we,
here.
We really are. I
this
mean,
this is getting really brainy.
We're going to a place we've never done before on Cable Talk for sure. So, but let's talk a little bit about the business of journalism and mm-hmm. then maybe the politics of journalism. You've worked in cable facts and in our industry as a reporter, so you've covered the issues. But now you're also on the business end of it as the publisher.
Yeah.
But publishing has changed. I mean, mm-hmm. CableFax produces a publication, but it's emailed. You know, it doesn't
yeah.
come over the fax machine as it used to, which was so cool.
We just love the name so much, though, that we can't.
It's hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
But I mean, the business of journalism and publishing has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And give us a sense of, you know, how you see it today and what you expect it to really evolve into over the next years.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, it's a very tough business. It's only gotten tougher. But when I think about it, when I really think about it over the last 20 years, and I haven't been a publisher during that entire time. I haven't really been that involved necessarily during the majority of that time on the business side, but I've always been exposed to it, and I've always been dealing with publishers, and I know what's going on with, you know, the finances and things like that. It's always been, I think B2B journalism, and just maybe journalism in general, has always been a relatively tough, cutthroat business, you know, where it's kind of like the media business and entertainment business in general and the things that your industry is dealing with in terms of just change all the time. And it's kind of been the same thing with the internet coming along in the late 90s is really what changed a lot of
right.
the game, right?
Really
so the value of content, the perceived value of, you know, journalism content went way down because people could suddenly get stuff for free, get a lot of stuff for free. And so everybody had to adjust to that. And I think that adjustment occurred a long time ago, and we've mm-hmm. gone through that. But I think today, well, there are two things. If you look at the B2B side, which is what I'm on,
mm-hmm.
That's trade journalism. And that's, I think there's some different issues there than on the consumer side. I mean, there are two sort of things. I don't know if you want to talk about one or the other, but
go where you want.
I mean, the one obviously that I'm involved in is B2B. And I think the challenge there is to keep justifying, in some ways it's a little easier than consumer journalism because if you really specialize in something and carve out your niche in that area mm-hmm. and you have your audience, you know who your audience is, as we hope we do at CableFax,
right.
then you can really, you can leverage that and be right. of high value because you're not going to get something that's quite that curated for you somewhere else, you
sure.
know, just by Googling and looking
right.
around. But on the other hand, there are certain aspects of it that are more challenging because you, especially in a industry that's consolidating as we have been for many, many years. Because then you have fewer players. You know, we have a premium product. You know, in our model, we have a premium newsletter product, as you mentioned, that's emailed out.
Mm-hmm.
And people pay a lot of money for that.
Right.
But when we have consolidation, it obviously, there are fewer people. I mean, jobs go away.
Sure.
People, you know, jobs get merged and things like that. So there are fewer people actually of the pool. So we have to keep expanding the pool of coverage of who we're going to keep that robust and keep making a case that, you know, so we start to cover things that are tangential to the industry that hopefully bring in new readers, new mm-hmm. people of interest. And we have to do that while we're also serving that core, you know, our core audience and not getting away from that because it's very valuable. And those are the people that really kind of love us and they have a lot of loyalty to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that business and we've had to expand, as you know, out into things like awards. We do a lot of awards now, which we actually love doing them because we view part of our role as a community builder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things
that's
evolved.
It really allows you to reach people that
yeah.
and stories that you might not have
otherwise
seen.
Yeah, definitely. It's actually, it's interesting, it actually feeds the journalism side in a way because we are able through the awards programs and through the events we do and things like that to sort of strengthen those relationships we already have with executives in the industry, and then they're more apt to call us back when we're doing a story.
Sure.
So it actually, both sides serve the other side. So, you know, but I think it's created for all of us, it's made, there's that and the events side is stuff that we didn't used to have to do 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was all, the focus was all on just putting that daily out every day.
Mm-hmm.
whatever your publication is. And now the focus has to be, well, let's do that, but we also have to do all these other things.
Right.
So it creates, it's a taxing environment for the staff. It actually creates more stress for everybody because we don't necessarily add new people.
Sure.
Because while we're doing that, part of the reason that you're expanding out is because maybe the business is shrinking on the advertising side or something like that because of consolidation, or maybe it's shrinking a little bit on the subscriber side. So you're making up for some of that lost revenue. And that's something that all the trades in many different industries are all dealing with right now. It's interesting how on the B2B side, I think I hear the same thing from other people in other trade magazines and publications.
Sure.
They cover all kinds of different industries. I mean, there's generally
ways,
just
right.
consolidation everywhere.
Yep,
I mean, that's
really
just been
is.
A general
And plus,
rule.
Just with the advent of the internet, where information is virtually
that's the other
freely
thing.
Available.
Exactly. I mean, some of it's pretty good, I admit.
Sure.
You can cobble together something. You can aggregate together some pretty good information with the tools that are out there. There are some people that maybe don't need us,
right.
And there are other people, though, that do. We try to be really valuable to the more senior. I mean, one of the things that we do, more so maybe than some of the other trades we compete with, is that we really try to cater to that senior audience. And so we write it in that way where it's an executive summary.
Yep.
It's supposed to be a quick read.
Quick download.
If you read the thing and if you're heading into a cocktail party or something,
right.
you can get in 10 minutes what happened that day. You're not going to be blindsided by somebody. You'll sort of sound like you know what you're talking
right.
about kind of
exactly.
thing. Right? So we try to really keep it on that. And that still is, that main core publication is really our flagship. And we still view that as our main product. But
right.
we have all these other things we do too now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about journalism. I was trained, as a reporter. To someday go work in a newspaper, which I did for a little bit.
So we all thought.
So we all thought, right?
And I'm glad I didn't. By the way, I have friends. I mean, not I love newspapers, but I have friends who had a really rough last 20 years doing
it's
that.
It's been rough. It really has been. I wouldn't even know how you would teach journalism today.
Yeah.
And as you said, I work in Washington, where I've seen over the last 25 years the nature of our politics basically disintegrate. With the divides of the parties, et cetera.
Even within the parties,
but things becoming so much more partisan. But to be honest, now maybe it's because of the rise of social media, which is so prevalent, where journalists are trying to outscoop or to get news out sooner. I see a lot of that same partisanship in journalism today. I don't know if you agree with that comment or what the role is for a journalist to use social media, but again, I see more division, whether it's politically or in our journalism today, than I see folks coming together, certainly from a journalistic perspective, with the tenets of impartiality, accuracy,
right.
fairness, objectivity. When, I read some tweets and it's like, I can almost see a political party writing that tweet from a quote-unquote journalist. And I don't think that's good, but I don't know. What's your
take? I would generally agree with you. I mean, I don't think it's a good thing. And I would agree that things have become more partisan among, when I was in journalism school, it's one of the first things I'm sure for you too.
Absolutely.
It's one of the first things they drum into your head is that you're not there to be the story. You're not there to comment on stuff,
sure.
unless you're on the opinion page.
Unless you label it.
You're a columnist or something,
right.
That's fine. But if you're actually a reporter and you're out reporting, you're talking to people and doing reports, as most of the people who are now pundits on TV. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take there's TV and print,
right.
Two slightly different things. I mean, on television, I think that it's a pretty bad state of affairs just because, when you have... Well, you have a few different cable channels, right? But you have three main ones. And there's not really any of them that you could really consider that objective necessarily.
Correct.
Two of them have specifically outwardly said who they are, and I think that's fine. I mean, if you're a if you sort of put it out there and say, look, we lean conservative, we lean liberal, one of them, I'm being careful not to name them, everyone knows
sure.
who I'm talking about, but one of them I think has become sort of the anti-Trump network.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're liberal or conservative, but they've just become, we've just decided
way, right?
we're just going to be against the administration.
Correct.
Because the administration beats up on us all the
exactly.
time and calls us out and doesn't seem to like our reporters or whatever. So it's like almost this like little fight happening. And that really is, it's funny. It's a hard, I think, journalists are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're being attacked all the time, it's hard to
not react
right. as a human being and to stay back and remember you're supposed to be objective. But I think that I'm not calling out any particular one. I think on TV, what happened, this all started in my mind about 15 or 20 years ago, where reporters, they used to just report, And then we had 24, when Ted Turner did CNN, right. When he came out with CNN, that was just the first one, and later with Fox News and all that. You know, they have to fill 24 hours a day.
Exactly.
And it's expensive yep. to send people out all over and to do these really intricate reports like, you know, these go out to Africa or something.
It's easier to have the panel.
It's easier to have a panel. Talking. It's cheaper. Mm-hmm. It's easier. Yep. And eventually what they decided was it's more exciting for viewers to watch people argue.
Yes.
Even if it's just our reporters who are supposed to be reporting things. Now they're here, you know, arguing and giving their opinion and everything. And it's become so common now that it's expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you just said, I don't know what they teach people in journalism school. I don't know if they teach you to also be a pundit now, because
right.
it apparently
it seems so.
You're supposed to be. And on the print side, which is different, but now all the print reporters are being forced to, and I think they're being pressured to go on television to give their opinion.
Isn't it the case?
You know, it's good for the publication. We need more publicity for this newspaper or that magazine or whatever, and this is good if you go on. You know, it's mm-hmm. gets your name out there, gets our publication out there. And so, but they're not going to have you on if you're just going to sit there and be it right down the middle.
Right.
They only have you on if you have like strong opinions
and
you're excited.
An opinion one way or the other, which is contrary to being an objective journalist in
yeah.
many ways.
It just, you know, and I think you could argue, it's funny, we used to have debates in college, you probably did too, you know, when we do have
sure.
these J-school classes, you know, what is objectivity?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most interesting things that I think we talked about one time, I think a professor brought this up, is that there really isn't any mm-hmm. true objectivity. You can only try, because all of us have subjective opinions that are based on our upbringing and everything else, right? And that colors everything that we, the way we view the world. And that's always going to be the case. I think is what you're mentioning, though, is that people don't seem to even be making an effort anymore.
Right.
But I think that, you know, just in something as simple as what you choose to cover, you know, not even how you cover it, but what you're looking at 5 or 6 different things that you can cover that day, whether you're a TV reporter or a print reporter or whatever the case may be. And you have to make a choice of where you're going to spend your time and what your priority is. And that's all based in your own subjective.
Sure.
opinion and bias. You know, you pick this story over that story, and why are you focusing on this and not that? And so that really means that there is no true, I mean, unless you're going to have a computer pick your stories for you or something, and that computer has some algorithm that's perfectly objective. I just don't know how you have human beings that are perfectly objective. But to your point, I don't think in journalism it's ever been quite this bad.
It is, and it's, I mean, I think that harms our ability to understand issues as factually as we can when we know that there is somewhat bias that's built in. You're right, and I know I always felt that, you're right, there is.
And I think it's on both sides, by the way. I'm
not
even
without
making
question,
like.
I mean, without question, yeah. I mean, this is in every case, and I know you're right, that a reporter brings certain bias to a story, but in the classical training that we had way back when, we're just showing how old we are, you were trained to sort of minimize that and work to get the sources, mm-hmm. to get the truth, to be as objective as you can and to take your opinion out of it. Where today, as you said, I mean, reporters today seek coverage on television or they seek coverage on the radio or whatever, or on these talk shows, and it's because they have a point of view that's different than what would be just simply straight.
Yeah, and
down
I would
the road.
I guess I would say I don't want to color everyone the same way, because I see people that go on all the time, especially I think it's better on the print side, frankly.
Yes.
And I don't say that just being a print
person. No, I think you're right.
But I think that they really, when they go on, when I see the print people go on the shows from major newspapers, whether it's, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, whatever the paper, Chicago Tribune, mm-hmm. LA Times, whatever. And I mean, there are a lot of people that have always thought that the mainstream press leans a certain way,
yes.
and that's fine, and that's the debate's been out there for decades.
Right.
But I do think that a lot of people come on from those outlets on the print side. If they're not coming from a magazine that's got a specific point of view, that's
mm-hmm.
different. You know, those people have an obvious
right.
opinion.
Clearly.
If they're coming from National Review or something,
sure.
that's fine. But if they're coming from a newspaper, I think they do make an attempt to be relatively, well, there's this side and that side. I think what we've gone into, though, at least in the last year, is that there is a level of extreme partisanship that has not existed before.
Correct.
And I think it forces people who are being asked to comment on the news, which is what you're doing as a journalist when they bring you on these shows. We want your comment. What do you think's happening? What's the
sure.
back and forth?
Sure. Get your take, right?
It's almost impossible not to insert. It's hard to answer to do that without being biased, you know, without inserting your opinion
exactly.
and coming down kind of on one side or the other. But I think it makes it harder to be objective when you have these extreme you know, you just have this extreme rhetoric
right.
on pretty much both sides. But certainly, you know, we have a White House right now that I think everyone would have to agree is a little more raring for a fight mm-hmm. than probably any White House that we've seen.
And
sort of the way that, you know, the fact that the president spoke of social media, the fact that the president's on Twitter all the time mm-hmm. in sort of an unfiltered way. Where he doesn't have people, as a president normally would, sort of filtering what he's saying.
Sure.
That makes it a whole different game. And he's very smart.
I'm
not in the camp that thinks that President Trump is stupid. And some people
I think
that. He's very, very, very smart. And he knows how to drive a news cycle. And he knows how to goad journalists into giving their opinion
yeah.
by attacking them or attacking their network and that sort of thing, and then getting them to talk about it all day.
Right.
And it's a really, and they fall into the trap all the time.
They
and
sure
it's,
do.
And then they go on TV and talk about how they're falling into the trap as they're actually falling into
the
trap.
I mean,
I've seen them sit there and comment, well, here we are talking about his tweet, and, you know, we're not talking about this other thing that happened today. And it's like, well, okay, well, how about talk about the other thing that just happened today? So that you're not, you know, actually, it's like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, let me ask you this question, and then we'll wrap up. You talked a little bit about the fact that we have these algorithms today that control speech that in many ways are controlled by the larger Facebooks, the Googles, et cetera. And we're seeing more of the AI to determine how we monitor speech, what speech is covered. And it's an issue with the president's tweets. As journalism students, we were mm-hmm. taught First Amendment, you know, keeping the government out of regulating speech,
yeah.
But now it almost seems like we have very large companies that are doing a lot more through algorithms and AI that are controlling speech, perhaps one way or the other. I don't know if that's your sense or not. I've certainly been following a few folks that have mm-hmm. been commenting on this, and you know, I heard one commentator say not too long ago that it's, you know, the government doesn't regulate speech, but today big tech does. Is that mm-hmm. something that, you know, as someone who works as a journalist covers?
Right. So the yeah, it's what we talked about earlier at the beginning, right? When we were talking about the old idea of the dystopian
mm-hmm,
future true. In which the government forces you to do this or that. Now we've got these tech companies that are through algorithms and through other methods. I think it started with here's the thing. I don't see anything immensely insidious in it yet. Although I do think that they're making an effort, I think these companies are making an effort to, first of all, stop things like hate speech or things where people seem to be inciting harm to other people. And I sort of understand why they want to try to filter that out. And I think it's the, you know, crying fire in a crowded theater element of the First Amendment. And it's always a really blurry line, right? Because can eventually, you know, you start out with that well-intentioned idea and it can sometimes start to go too far. And I don't know if they've gone too far yet, and I think it's unclear based on, I mean, they haven't really given the information out that people have asked them. They've been very wishy, they've been very kind of, I think there's been some inability for them to articulate quite how they do these algorithms, and maybe they're doing that on purpose. And I think for those of us who aren't tech gurus, I don't even think we understand exactly what's going on.
Hardly.
But I think that's how it started. I think it was started as a well-intentioned thing. And this goes back to, you know, when YouTube started and they would keep, so you have to keep pornographic content off.
Right.
There are lots
of
things that they have to filter out and keep out of there. And it's the same thing with, I think, these social media networks trying to stop, you know, online harassment.
Exactly.
Things that I don't think any of us, I mean, look, free speech is a really, it's a tough thing. You know, there are some libertarians who would say that all free speech, no matter how disgusting, should just be allowed to be out there. But I think there's a difference between maybe the government doing it mm-hmm. versus a private company, mm-hmm. because people can obviously vote with their pocketbooks and go to some other social network if they don't like that one. Mm-hmm. That's like an old excuse
although
that people say.
Although that's the issue today, because now,
but now they have
people
a little
are
bit.
So connected to these tech companies, whether it's for you know, their posts or you name it, that it's almost as if they can't get away from it. So there is an enormous amount
right.
of control.
Well, that's the question. When
I know one thing for sure. We're never going to answer that question yet, but we will see how that plays out. But, Mike, it's been great to have you with us here at Cable Talk. I've got one more question for you. Who's the most interesting person you ever interviewed?
Of all the people I've interviewed?
Of all the people that you have interviewed.
You know, I'll tell you something. I don't... It's hard to, I really have so many people that have been so interesting to talk to. You know, obviously you know that you're giving me you're teasing me all the time about, but I live in Los Angeles, and so I tend to go to some of these events.
Mr. Red Carpet right here, folks.
So I get to talk to occasionally.
And you oftentimes tweet at the superhero gala event, which like just makes my blood boil because I'm such a superhero geek.
There you go. Yeah, that's all it is anymore, too. It's like all the movie premieres.
Pretty much,
pretty much all Marvel and Star Wars. I was one of the most cool things. One of the people I got to sit down with was Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, interesting.
Who, A Clockwork Orange was one of the weirdest, craziest movies I've ever seen. Stanley Kubrick and so many things he'd done after that, and just being able to sit down with him decades later, and kind of he reflected on how crazy that was because he was a young kid at the time.
Yeah, he was really young at the time.
And that put him out there, and then it typecast him for a long time. He'd only play evil people, and he just is a really interesting guy who's so he's kind of a legendary actor, but he's kept himself a little bit. He hasn't really tried to be in every movie, and he's just he pops up in various TV shows
Once in a while, right?
And he's a really it's just a really interesting conversation with a person who's just kind of very comfortable in his skin and where he is right now. And he had these crazy times in the, at a crazy movie he did in the 60s, and it led to other things. But, so that was really, and they're a lot like that.
I'm sure.
But, most, but really in the industry, you, Matt.
Get out of here.
The absolute most interesting. I
mean. You're too kind. Well, Mike Reb. Great to have you with us on Cable Talk. It is great to work with you. Thank you so much for how you've supported our members. You mentioned awards. We thank you for what CableFax has done with the Independent Cable Operator of the Year Award, where many of our members have really sought after that award.
It's great. It's our favorite. It's really one of our favorites to do because...
And they work hard for it.
We find such great stories out of that. Just the things that are going on in local communities that we don't normally hear about. And obviously you guys help us out and let us know what's going on. So,
but you connect with them and you tell their story, and we appreciate that. So, folks, this is Mike Greb, Matt Polka here with ACA Cable Talk. Don't forget, subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next time on Cable Talk.